net. Thanks for coming back to KBOO.
Thanks for having me, Joseph.
So, Jeff, you have a big essay you've written, and it's coming out very soon. It's called Portlandageddon. How long is it, and when is it out?
It's thousands and thousands of words with lots of images, and it comes out Tuesday morning.
How long have you been working on this?
I've been working it on and off and on for a couple of years, actually. Every time I think I'm done, a new thing seems to happen in Portland that turns the scene over. It's this major sea change. And I've been kind of waiting for the right time to take stock of the entire corpus or the entire body of health of the art scene here, and because so many changes have occurred. And I just got back from traveling the Midwest, and actually it's a great time to just finish it off and push it out, because we're nearing towards the end of the year, kind of home stretch, and it's a good time to take stock of things, because it's just going to keep changing even more.
Mm-hmm. Geddon, it sounds kind of apocalyptic, like there might be some destruction involved. What's going on?
Well, Picasso had a great quote, which is, every act of creation is also an act of destruction. And to be sure, Portland has been changing tremendously, especially within the last, like, 6 years or so. I'm part of the wave that moved here in the end of the 20th century, just before the Y2K thing. And a lot of artists decamped here in Portland and decided that this was going to be an art city, whether it knew it or not, because we were moving here and this was the kind of program that we were going to install in the city. And a lot of people gave a lot of pushback at first, and I was kind of the voice of this horde of artists that were moving to Portland, and one of the most active voices. And what I did is I articulated what was going to happen. Well, a lot of it came to pass, that this is actually now known internationally as an art city. The question now is, how do we keep it that way? How do we protect, and also how do we spur it on further in the future? And really, Portlandageddon, which I loved as a title, also kind of adds a little bit of urgency to it, which I think is important. I think a lot of times the arts die because of a lack of urgency. It's sort of like, we'll take care of this arts affordability thing when we get around to it, or studio space when we get around to it, or the lack of collector base when we get around to it, or what about our art schools, our art museums? And really, what I think Portlandageddon is about is looking at the urgency and how art criticism can kind of spur on the discussion of what we really want to do, not simply talking about community or craft, which are two words that Portland uses a lot about itself. Mm-hmm. But it usually shuts down the conversation instead of building up. You want to ask, what kind of community are you talking about? What kind of craft? Instead of using an overarching term, give me specifics and let's talk about it in detail. And that's what criticism does.
Mm-hmm. So in this city, you know, arts institutions pop up and then kind of vanish. You've been doing the same thing for so long. You are one of the institutions here. What is that? When that happens, you know, like a art center flares up and then vanishes, are you okay with that, or do you think it went away because of some forces fight against it?
Well, there's a lot of different things. I mean, people will talk about the Museum of Contemporary Craft, kind of, you know, an old institution. Well, they decided to, and I wrote about this when it happened, that they needed to, when they did the move down into the Pearl District, they didn't also create an endowment around it. And there's kind of this sort of almost naive way of saying, okay, we'll just go there and we'll see and this great thing will happen. But really, something that you really have to do is kind of develop funding. And it's not the sexiest to have endowments. It's basically a pile of money that just pays you a little bit of money every month, but it gives you kind of a financial basis. And time and again, a lot of institutions don't do this, but the one institution that has been doing a lot more of it than the others, which is the Portland Art Museum, Brian Ferrizzo, it's been something he had been quietly doing before they announced this new wing design. They were endowing specific programs and positions, and it's not sexy, but it makes it so that when you have an economic downturn, you don't suddenly have to let a bunch of people go. Mm-hmm. And it's important to do that. And with the Museum of Contemporary Craft, I thought it was a great idea. I think they probably should have stayed as an arts craft club instead of trying to become a contemporary arts center in addition to it. But they could have done it had they gone and actually raised an endowment. The only problem with that is when they combined with PNCA, they had maybe a 6 to 8 month window to do that before PNCA themselves were going to be doing a major fundraising campaign to move into the 511 building. So they basically had a bus that was, they were sitting in the middle of the road, and there was a bus about to hit them. By the time that, you know, they had numerous directors after that, but to a certain point, once PNCA got going on their fundraising initiative, they were dead in the water because they were under the umbrella to that. So you have to have an identity for an arts institution. And one of the identity problems that the Museum of Contemporary Craft has is they focus so much on handmade stuff, whereas really craft is about tool making and techne, which is the Greek word for technique. That's their word for art. And it's about, we're tool making animals. So if you're staying away from the digital tools that are available out there, you're missing a big part of the craft discussion. So even though the craft discussion was moving on, that institution kind of wasn't tapping into the design crowd in town. They were having very cluttered exhibitions that kind of drove people away. And
now it's been absorbed into PNCA, and you can go, there's like one little room where you can see a bit of their collection every now and again. It's not very impressive. What's going on at the School of Craft?
Oregon College of Art and Craft is a different thing altogether. Probably maybe a sister institution to the Museum of Contemporary Craft, and there's now talk of a merger between them and PNCA, and it's a thorny issue because, like I said, it could be a great thing for PNCA and for OCAC, stabilize the two. But the problem is that higher education overall is going through this tremendous shift right now. And it's making these institutions very enrollment driven. So if they all of a sudden have like a 25 or 30% drop in enrollment, suddenly the institution's in big trouble. And once again, you need endowment money to weather those storms. So I'm a little suspicious of combining two schools that basically will have the exact same problem. If there's a downturn, or if they somehow have a lull in enrollment, they're both in the same state, even if they combine. Also, there's really two different cultures to these institutions. And there's a website out there now, which is some of the alumni of OCAC, they kind of see that the two schools are very different, and they're not certain about the merger of these two schools.
But they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't share a location, right? They would carry separate identities.
They'd have to carry out separate identities to really make it work, because they are so incredibly different. And there is a possibility to really make it work and be great, but it would take tremendous care. And the problem I see is that none of the arts organizations in Portland have ever shown that they're that precision. They're not that surgical. They're more pragmatic. They take whatever's kind of in front of them that's available that they can kind of do. It's partially because of funding. They don't do a lot of visioning and planning, which kind of leads to the main thing that's kind of driving my publishing of Portland again right now is this arts affordability plan that the city council is putting forward. I think it's great that the city council is doing this arts affordability plan, but at the same time, maybe it's the wrong title and the wrong approach to what we need, because it's not just about affordability. Portland's gone through a tremendous change with a tremendous number of jobs have been added in the design and tech fields here. Are those firms, and they're displacing a lot of artist studios and more derelict buildings, shall we say. But to a certain degree, those buildings are like coral reefs. They breed artists and creative endeavors. And if you tear them down and you put up new buildings, you're kind of it sanitizes everything. So you go from a living, breathing coral reef to what is essentially a series of small, discrete aquariums, and it's not the same thing.
Have you found that for all the tech money, you know, these companies get I don't know, Vacasa, they got $68 million the other day in funding. I mean, that is so they can hire staff and rent a beautiful new building in the Pearl. Do you see anyone in these fields spending money on art?
Well, some of them do. I'm not going to say that they don't, but by and large, unless you're talking about Paul Allen, who we'll talk about later, a lot of them are not really involved as patrons. At the same time, they like to hang out in the coffee shops and restaurants and whatnot that have kind of an arty vibe. And a lot of these are being provided by the artists. So the artists are creating the environment that they like to work within, the kind of general creative flow that is within the city. Mm-hmm. But they haven't stepped up as patrons. And to a certain extent, it's also because the visual arts hasn't really engaged the tech world all that much. Now, that's not true of all artists. I think there's an important cadre of artists in Portland who I've supported. I've always been kind of a promoter of new media art in Portland. We've done virtual reality shows of people like the Portland Immersive Media Group or Tabitha Nicolai, Damian Gilley. There's a whole variety of artists who utilize technology, and I'd say that the tech firms are interested in this. I know Damian works with them a great deal, but our institutions haven't jumped on that bandwagon as much. I did a show a couple of years ago, and we did a radio program with Adam Simmons, and I did a show at the University of Oregon all about new media. But in terms of these tech billionaires actually, or at least millionaires, are they going out and buying paintings? It's not the same. So there's a disconnect there. And I think maybe our galleries need to switch their focus, but also our museums and other nonprofit institutions need to really look at art that involves technology and design a lot more.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Jeff Yarn. He's the publisher and chief critic at Port, which is a website of art criticism, and it's at portlandart.net. We were talking about institutions changing quickly. The Art Institute, which was a kind of a chain art school, not very big, that closed down, and then Merrillhurst University closed down, and they scattered, you know, their art therapists to Lewis and Clark, and they always had the gym, you know, which was always supporting contemporary art. What does that make? Are they symptoms of something, or you know, why would they close down, and does it matter?
Well, there's a real crisis in higher education right now. Partially, it's because a lot of these institutions, it's a funding thing. A lot of the student loan money used to come directly from the federal government, and the federal government was really the lender. Then something changed, I think it was during the Bush era, where really these institutions became the bank and the lenders for these loans as well. So when students default on loans, it puts a drag on the institution as well. And so there's been this tremendous sort of and it's not just art schools, it's liberal arts schools, smaller colleges, anybody who doesn't have a really large endowment or doesn't have an endowment that that can really fund the general operation of the institution. Because, you know, Merrill Hurst University closed, even though I believe they had like a $36 million in their endowment. So they had money there, but they couldn't utilize it to keep the doors open. And if you also default rates, other things like that can affect the accreditation of the school. So if a school is deaccredited, literally everybody who has gotten a degree from them, their degree is in jeopardy. And so I think Merrill Hurst University chose to close rather than put all of that in jeopardy. But it's, and you know, the Art Institute things, there's been a kind of a lot of you know, are these some institutions that are less serious, you know, they've put out, what is the word? They're kind of almost like puppy mills where they give out a lot of student loans and, you know, they're going to go and try and do this for-profit higher education.
You're saying the value of their degree is not very high. They'll give anyone a degree.
Yeah, they'll give anybody a degree. That's kind of the problem, but it's affecting even serious institutions like Merrill Hurst, which also closed. So there's a great shift going on. And it's very unfortunate, and a lot of it's driven by the fact that instead of the federal government sort of supporting higher education, they've gotten more out of that game. And that's why there's a lot of talk about, you know, loan forgiveness if you're teaching and that sort of thing. It's a major drag on the economy and everything else. There's something broken in higher education at the moment, and it's not just art schools, it's all schools. And nobody really seems to have an answer for it.
When you go to PSU, there's the Littman Gallery there. You go there a lot. What are they, one of the galleries that you feel, you know, people should get excited about? Tourists should try and go there?
Oh, yeah. They're actually one of the very best galleries in Portland. What I like about it is it's actually programmed by the students at PSU. And I've curated, I believe, three shows.
By the art students or everyone?
By the art students at PSU. But it's closer to the student body that way because it's actually the student body that's curating it. So they're a bit more adventurous. I find that a lot of the curators and directors of nonprofit, particularly college schools, kind of put on shows that they think they should be putting on, whereas students ultimately will, it's like, no, we got to put on a show like this. There's a different energy to it. And I curate as well. I've curated three shows at the Littman Gallery, some like play and foreground, some of the more famous exhibitions they put on. But what I like about that is that they're really there's an urgency to the exhibitions there. And really, I mean, academic galleries sometimes can be too academic. And what that is a kind of a student body gallery, and it's a great location. And a lot of the Art Gym was one of the most important college galleries in the area, and it's closed not because the Art Gym wasn't doing well, but because the institution that was its umbrella institution closed. You know, it's losing something like that. But almost all of the college art galleries are under a certain amount of pressure from their higher up administrations, especially if it's not an art school. And I think all of the administrators should think differently about that, because it's really their interface with the community and with their student body in a way that's difficult to quantify. It's difficult to quantify what's going on with art. When a student walks into an exhibition, they have an experience that is expansive and a little bit confusing. But it's not laid out like typical academia, where you have a course plan and here you're studying a subject and here are the key points that you have. It's much more open-ended, and it's actually closer to the real world. So closing your art, your college art galleries, and a number of them have been in a great deal of also the White Box closed. Really important, great exhibition space. Yeah, the White Box closed, and it was a tremendous lack of vision from that institution. The U of O should be ashamed of themselves.
That's the U of O in Portland, in right. the White Stack.
Yeah, and because it was a great program, it was really needed, and it was a great interface, and you know, it was just sort of low hanging fruit for them. The art school there eventually, you know. They realized that they were being picked apart and stood up for themselves, but not before losing an important organ, basically their toehold in the art scene in Portland.
Do you think when like an 18-year-old is touring universities, they should go look at the art gallery?
Absolutely. I think if an 18-year-old is looking at a college, they should always look at an art gallery. I know Jordan Schnitzer has been funding a lot of university art galleries and museums. PSU is getting one with his name on it. And I visited the, I visited a couple of the other museums that he's helped put together recently. One out in Pullman was the most recent one I've been to. But he has an initiative all throughout the country with that sort of thing, and it's, I think partially he's doing it because a lot of the administrations don't see the point of having an art museum or an art gallery, but really it speaks to the health of the campus life, that you're going to have interesting open-ended experiences, which is really what the college experience is. Otherwise, you just should just take your courses online and fill, you know, should check them out. The campus experience is about being away from home for the first time often and finding yourself. And the best way to do that sometimes is to get lost in a museum. And then you run into like-minded people who are just as confused about what they're looking at as you are. And that's really what an art experience is about. It's about not knowing the outcomes, but in a safe way. It's different than, you know, walking out into the veldt and hoping a lion doesn't jump you.
In the last few minutes, just say, talk a bit about, you talked about Jordan Schnitzer, and I know you know him well, and you've sort of traveled with him looking at art. What about Paul Allen? What was the, what did he bring with his money? What did he bring to the art world?
What I liked, and I was in the room many times with Paul Allen, but I never like sat down and talked to him, partially because I'm a little bit shy, and also I'm not just work in the room. But what I liked about Paul Allen was he was kind of an Uber geek, not the ride sharing service, but really a geek for geek's sake. He was a guitarist who loved Jimi Hendrix. He was really interested in saving elephants. He had his sports teams, but he was also really into art, and that's really rare for a tech billionaire. Of the tech billionaires, he's the one who seemed to care about the larger culture more.
Don't billionaires tend to just buy investment art, you know? Was he pushing the envelope a bit more?
He pushed the envelope a bit more than that. They've funded numerous arts institutions throughout the world, but a lot in the Pacific Northwest. A lot of exhibitions were partially underwritten by the Vulcan or the Paul Allen Foundation. And I'm assuming that the foundation will continue in some form. I believe his sister is going to have, but it's going to be different when the person driving it isn't there. What I like about a billionaire who has money, and it's easy to hate the rich, but it's good because they have they keep their own counsel, they have their own whims, and it's a little bit, it's not a decision made by committee. It's sort of like, they're interested in what they're passionate about a lot of times. And Paul Allen was that sort of person. He bought art that he was passionate about. He was passionate about combination of art and science as well, which I don't think you get as much of that. He spurred on the Seattle Art Fair and got people buying up there.
His Twitter feed was really, in the last year, was all about the art fair. I mean, he didn't tweet very much, but he was very proud of that.
Yeah, because, you know, once again, And people complain about marketplaces and art fairs, but really, you know, sometimes if you're really busy, if you have the money to spend on, not all art is multi-billion dollars or multi-million dollars. A lot of art is affordable to people who, you know, maybe it isn't, if you're at subsistence level, you shouldn't be buying several thousand dollars worth of art. But if you have some discretionary income, it actually is a way of realigning the excesses and the or the surplus that you might have with the culture at large, it is really a generator for. I like to say that art is like an instrument panel, except you don't know what any of the instruments are reading. And so if you see this one gauge that's just sort of redlining and going off on one and little whistle going off and steam jetting out of it, you're like, huh, I wonder what that measures. That's what art does. It's for all the things in reality that are not totally nailed down or completely understood already. And a lot of people have trouble understanding, you know, well, what is art for? It's for building understanding of things that are not fully understood yet, which kind of makes me want to bring things back to this arts affordability plan with City Council. It needs to be more than about affordability. We really need a plan. A city like Houston wants to, everything that they do, they focus on being an important arts hub, and therefore all of the civic money that they put into their arts funding organizations, that's what their grants go to. And we could look at RAC, which is going through a realignment as well, part of this Portlandageddon. Everything seems to be up in the air. When RAC is doing this realignment, they need to look at how they're funding. And I think a crucial part of my essay that I'm talking about is that RAC should be these panels that they convene. They oftentimes have a lot of people on these panels that you wonder, well, how, you know, what are their qualifications? Are they paying their panelists? Because oftentimes you don't get, you get what you pay for, just even if it's a nominal fee for the amount of time that people are putting in there. Also, you have good people and they don't, they'll use them once and then they won't use them again for 10 or 15 years. And there's only so many knowledgeable people out there. You burn through your good pile pretty quickly, and I think they need to look at things. So this arts affordability plan should be more about this arts seriousness plan, because honestly, the economic changes that are happening in Portland are like a bus that are coming. You can't turn back the clock to the cheap days. So what you can do is you can be more serious about the money that you're using and have already and appropriate it and say, okay, who are the serious artists who are really making changes? And Portland a lot of times doesn't fund art that challenges what Portland is about. We like to do sort of token art that can be a little multicultural, but they don't fund, let's say, an artist who is of Mexican descent who really challenges the establishment about things and makes people a little uncomfortable. The second people get a little uncomfortable about things, they get a little squeamish about the funding and presenting it at our arts organizations. And really, that's what we should be doing. We should be looking at what makes us a little uncomfortable. Art's good at that.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Jeff Yarn. His essay, Portlandageddon, is out October 23rd. That's today. And he is the publisher and chief critic at Port, which is at portlandart.net. Thanks for coming back to KBOO, Jeff.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Alebrijes, the Milagro Theater annual Día de los Muertos theater production, running weekly on Thursday, Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays until November 11th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Alebrijes is a family-friendly production of real-life artist and Alebrijes creator Pedro Linares, delves into his world and fictionalizes it to create this Día de los Muertos story. Full of mythical creatures, psychedelic jungles, song, dance, and larger-than-life puppetry. Again, that's Alebrijes, the Milagro Theater annual Día de los Muertos theater production running weekly on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sundays until November 11th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 2nd from noon to 10 p.m. at St. Andrew's Church in Portland. This is the 10-year anniversary of the celebration of Dia de los Muertos in Portland. There will be altar building, Muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, storytelling for children, traditional Mexican food, drink, and live musical performances. Benefiting No Olvidados, a border group that is providing water out in the desert for immigrants. Again, that's the Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 2nd from noon to 10 p.m. at St. Andrew's Church, 806 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Así que vamos a delirar, deliremos por un ratito.